What does the Apostolic Creed, let's take that one, what does it stress? Who is mentioned by name in the Apostolic Creed? Let's just, who is mentioned in the Apostolic Creed by name? The names, the persons that appear in the Apostolic Creed.
God the Father.
The Father, okay.
Jesus,
Mary. Let's say Mary.
Pilate.
Pontius Pilate. Wow. What a threesome. Jesus. Ich glaube an Jesus Christus. I believe in Jesus Christ. Credo in Jesum Christum in Latin. Okay, so I believe in Jesus Christ. Born of the Virgin Mary, suffered and died under Pontius Pilate. Now, why is this strange Roman creepy guy, Pontius Pilate, in our Apostles' Creed? Can you answer this question? Why did the early Christians, when they were baptized, because that's where it comes from, why did they have to say this? So the origin of the Apostolic Creed, of the Apostles' Creed, is in the baptismal formula. I was once in Jerusalem, and a friend of mine was the Danish pastor, the pastor of the Danish Lutheran Church. So I went to the Danish Lutheran Church. I thought I could practice my Danish a little bit. Danish is basically Norwegian pronounced wrongly. Sorry for all my Danish friends who hear this. So anyway, and they said, that's because they were Lutheran. So we all stood up and we said, okay, let's say the Apostles' Creed. So we stood up and I wanted to start in Danish. I believe in God the Father, jeg tror på Gud Faderen. And then before that, they said something, which I really was going like, what? They said, I'm renouncing, that's the word I'm looking for. I renounce the devil and all his works and doing and his being. So they go, I renounce the devil and I believe in God the Father, I believe in Jesus Christ, I believe in the Holy Spirit. So where does this come from? This comes from the baptismal vows. When they were baptized, first of all, they had to renounce all the heathen gods. They had to renounce their old religion. They had to renounce the devil. And after that, they were asked, do you believe in God the Father? And then they said, I believe in God the Father and the maker of heaven and earth, which is against Gnosticism and Docetism, a real, and I believe in Jesus Christ, I believe in the Holy Spirit. So they were asked, do you believe? Yes, I believe. Do you believe? Yes, I believe. Do you believe? Yes, I believe. Now, why do we have Pontius Pilate? Pontius Pilate is a historical reference. We know that Pontius Pilate ruled in Judea from the year 26 through 36. 10 years, that was his span, that was the normal span that they had as a governor. Then they were moved to another place in the Roman Empire. So when we say in the Apostles' Creed, or when the early Christians rather said in the Apostles' Creed, we believe in Jesus Christ who suffered and died, was crucified under Pontius Pilate, it means it is a historic fact and we can date it, okay, within 10 years, but at least that's what it indicates. So we're not believing in some sort of like some religion that has no grounding in history. And that's why it is so important. So the people who were witnessing to their faith, the simple people, maybe they could tell some Jesus stories. Maybe they could just say the Apostles' Creed and says, okay, what are you? Why are you always going to that strange meeting on the Sunday morning or Sunday evening? Often a lot of the people that made up the church in the first two centuries were slaves, meaning they were not free. So they had to work all day. That's why Pliny the Younger, who was the governor of Bithynia, which is in Western Turkey, when he wrote to Emperor Trajan about the Christians in the year 112, he said, these Christians, They don't commit any crimes, but they do something strange. On a certain day in the week, they gather very early in the morning. They sing hymns to Christ as their God. Then they go off to work. And in the evening, they come back together again. And they eat some kind of a food together, a meal, which is quite innocent, which is an interesting remark, because the Christians were accused of eating the children, cannibalism. So Pliny says to, he's also a prefect of that region, writes to Emperor Trajan and says, hey, they eat normal food, basically. So what did the Christians do? They meet in the morning and they meet in the evening. So maybe that's what they could say. They were simple Christians. They said, we believe in Jesus. We are Christians. We know some stories about Jesus. And we believe in the crucified Lord. And that's where, and that's, I'll take, I think we should take our break now. Is that, good, I think. So they would concentrate their message on the cross and the resurrection and on the historic Jesus. And before we take the break, just to say, this was, now do you write resurrection with a double S in English, yes or no? S. And one R? Okay, thank you very much. In German, it's a much easier word, Auferstehung. Okay, anyway. This was supposed to be a joke. Okay. Anyway, so they would say, we believe in a crucified Christ who was recently, remember, this is just a few years ago, a few decades ago, recently, he was a Jew, and he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. But he was God raised him from the dead. So what would the result or the reaction of a normal Roman citizen be to this message? What would it be? The normal response would be, you are crazy. Okay, you are crazy. Who would believe in a Jew, number one, who was crucified, which is the criminal death, that's the death for the outlaws, the non-Romans? Even Paul was not crucified because he was a Roman citizen. He had the privilege of having his head cut off, which is a nicer way of dying than a crucifixion. So how crazy is it to believe in a crucified God? And how crazy is it, again, to believe in a resurrection? We know that the body is not so important. It's just about the soul. So actually they were with their message, they were in a difficult position. But what spoke for them is their life and their community. And we'll speak about that in the second part. And I believe in my assessment, in my understanding, as far as I can see now, the life of the Christians of that time spoke louder than their witness and their apology. That was mostly subsequent. So people would meet Christians, then they would be wondering why these people are living in a different way. And after that, people would start about the faith. So the evangelism did not precede, but it came after encountering Christians. The way we sometimes think of evangelism is we go out in the street, these people have never met us, we're sharing a tract with them, and I'm not against that at all, okay? People have come to a faith through a tract. I'm not attacking this. I'm just saying the thought process is different. I believe at that time it was more the life and the community and the miracles that happened. And I'll speak more about that. The life of the Christians also over against their non-Christian neighbors, which caused people to then ask, what is the hope that is in you? Like 1 Peter 3:15 says. And then they would share. So the sharing was in the context of a personal encounter, but it was not as if you could take a message and isolate this message from your life and then share a message and leave it with the person and you retreat into your safe zone, which is, I think, how we sometimes think about evangelistic outreach. You know, let's all gather, go out, and then we come back. Celebrate our victories, or lick our wounds. But I see this as more integrated. I will now continue, and I want to go a little bit more structured for just a moment, because before I go into all different areas again, like I always do, okay? So when we talk about the apologists, I've written this in also in the outline that you have on your app. They had a number of different focuses, and I'll just read what I've wrote here, written here. These early Christian leaders and writers, they identified a number of different tasks or needs. Number one, to explain the main tenets of the faith to outsiders. So that's the explanation, explain. Second, to defend the faith against criticism and against this tendency to outlaw Christians and to persecute them and kill them. So to explain, to defend. Then thirdly, to demonstrate the superiority of the faith over Judaism and traditional religions, which you can also call paganism. So that's interesting, because they had to show to the Roman world why they were different from the Jews. Now, the Jews were accepted as an exception. Okay, every people group who became part of the Roman Empire, when they conquered, had to at least worship or give veneration to the emperor, except for the Jews. The Jews did not have to do it. They had a special exemption, a special permission to not have to worship the emperor. So the Christians also didn't venerate or worship the emperor. But then the Jews said, hey, these guys are not Jews. They should have to do that. So the Christians were in a little bit of a precarious situation, because they were made up of Jews who believed in Messiah, and they were made up of non-Jews. So they formed a new group, which they called, and is sometimes called, I'll stand up for that, sometimes called tertium, okay, this should be, let me write it again in capitals, it's easier. Tertium gens, so the third, tertium is the third, and gens, or gen, in English you would say gens, you know that from Gentiles, so the third kind of people. There's Jews, there's non-Jews, and then there's a third kind. And we, the Christians, are the third kind. So they are trying, and this is my third point here, the apologists are trying to explain how the Christian faith differs from Judaism, which was accepted as an exception, and from the other, the old religions. So a lot of, when you read the apologists, any of them which you find in the early Christian writers, you will often find that they are trying to explain how they are not like Jews, because they are not so legalistic, or they don't have to keep the Sabbath day, or they don't have all these rules about food and so forth. But they will also speak about how they, as Christians, do not believe the superstitions of the pagan religions. And often they ridicule the traditional religion. So they say, for example, how can you believe in Zeus, Zeus, I don't know how in your language you said, Zeus, the Greek god, or Jupiter is his Latin name. How can you believe in Zeus as the supreme god if he actually rapes women? Or if he has a relationship, he becomes a swan and then he has a sexual relationship with a human being. Or if he gets angry or he has constant trouble with his wife, Hera, because he has these extramarital relationships. And you know, what kind of nonsense is that? And so they go through all the traditional religions and say and show the nonsense that they are from the point of view of Christianity or the point of view of monotheism, of Jewish monotheism. So that's what they try to do. And of course, nowadays, we would, in our apologetics, we would not have those two, shall I say, enemies or those two reference points. So if we would be defending the Christian faith, we would probably not take as our opponents the Jews or the pagan religions. The pagan religions are sort of like dead, slowly coming back in some places, but, you know, slowly. But maybe our apologetics would be against secular humanism, against Islam, maybe. You know, whatever thought systems or religious systems there are that we are facing. So in Germany nowadays, I feel that the church is very unequipped apologetically to answer, for example, against Islam. We have now in Germany, in some of our regions, or what we call the federal states, the Bundesländer, we have in three of them, this was the newest statistic, that the boy's name that was chosen the most is Muhammad, for newborn boys, okay, newborn babies. So Muhammad is the, in three, so what does that mean? It means that the Muslim presence in Germany is growing, but if you ask a average churchgoer to tell us even the difference between Islam and Christianity, they would probably not know to say very much. So the apologists, and that was to your question, Andrew, the apologists were officially writing to outsiders, but at the same time, they were trying to educate their own people. And I think that is probably what we have to do too. So they wanted to explain the faith, they wanted to defend the faith, they wanted to demonstrate the superiority, they wanted to, and I've just said that, equip the Christians for the witness and the defense of the faith. And then thirdly, fifthly, they wanted to argue against heretical distortions of the faith, such as the various and nefarious Gnostic heresies. And that, I think, is important to understand. Now, in their arguments, and I will take a new white paper here. So in their arguments, they had some strains or some things that I think are recurring themes. And I will just give these to you. The first one is that faith and logic are not enemies. So they go together. That's one of the things that the early Christian writers and apologists try to stress. They try to stress and say, hey, listen, our faith is logical. It is logical to believe in one God rather than in many gods like the heathen do. Our faith is logical in that we say that God is the creator of a good creation, and therefore everything is in a cosmic order. And that makes sense. When you look at the stars, how they are moving, and it's all ordered. So they had this argument of faith and logic. Nowadays, I think this is a little bit harder to defend, this kind of argument. But when you go deep into apologetics, I think you can. But it's something that needs maybe a little bit of work. So basically, they followed Jesus when he said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your mind." So the mind as an instrument of expressing faith and love to God was for them, I think, important. So the faith can be explained in logical and philosophical terms. It does provide answers to mankind's deepest questions, perplexities, and needs. Now, a subsection of that was that when they spoke about the earlier religions or traditional religions, there were two approaches by the Christian apologists. The one strand said, everything that the heathen believe is nonsense and is actually originally from the devil. So the devil is deceiving people to believe in all of these gods, and these gods are basically just demons and their emanations of the devil and different kinds of demonic forces. So that's what the one strand says. But later, another strand became more prominent, and they said, no. When we look at the pagan religions, even, of course, Judaism anyway, because it belongs to our faith history, because we're rooted in the Old Testament. But they would say there is something which they called logos spermatikos, the seed word. Logos is the word, and spermatikos means the seed. The word, the logos, is there in a seed form already in the original, in the old religions. So they were on a journey to find traces of the old religions that would support the Christian faith. And they would find that especially in the philosophers like Socrates and Plato, and say, listen, Plato already said there must be one highest good overall. Plato already overcame the traditional religious polytheism, belief in many gods. He already said all of these gods that the Greeks believed in really come point to one original God who is overall, which is the ultimate good, the ultimate wise, the ultimate power. So there is something, and then in Latin we often speak about that this logos spermaticos, so the seed of the logos in the ancient religions and the ancient philosophies constituted something that is called in Latin preparatio evangelica, and I will just write that, preparatio evangelica or evangelica, which means the preparation, I should never speak and write at the same time because I always make mistakes. So preparatio evangelica, which means the gospel preparation. There is a gospel preparation in other religions. Now this is very interesting, I think, and also in our sharing, because we want to learn from the early church. So what can we learn here at this point? I think we can find in other religious systems, but especially because we live in such an individualistic world, we can find points of contact that are preparations for the gospel in the life of an individual or in the life of a group. I'll give you a little bit of an example just to explain what I mean by this. As I said, I'm involved in Bible translation in Africa, but we once met Bible translators who had worked in the Amazon region with a South American Indian tribe. And they said that when they translated the Gospels, there was no response from the people. When they translated Genesis and so forth, it somehow did not resonate with the people. But when they came to Revelation, suddenly the people got very, very interested and very open. Because number one, in Revelations, you have a dragon that flies through heaven, like, you know, a beast that's flying through through the sky. And they said, we also know this. In our mythology, there is a snake that is flying over us, and we're afraid of the snake. So we're trying to hide under the trees that the snake will not see us. So, and then in Revelation it says that the dragon was killed by Christ. So they said, this is great news. The snake is dead, okay? So, and then they also said, okay, in Revelation 22, where it says there is a river coming from the throne of God, and it is crystal clear, and on both sides of the river, there's these 12 trees, and the leaves are bringing healing to the nations. They say, well, we also have all these trees that have healing capacities, and we know which trees are good for healing for what, where we can use it as a medicine. But so that resonates with us. But our Amazon River here is always muddy and dirty. So to read of a river that is crystal clear, isn't that wonderful? So that's interesting, because when you look at it under the viewpoint of preparatio evangelica, a preparation of the gospel, apparently there this kind of evangelistic approach would look not for differences, but for points of contact. And that's what's the early Christians tried to do. So some people, they just fought against the traditional religion and said it's all nonsense. And look at how the gospel story and the concept of God that we bring to you is so much superior. And others said, no, let's look at what they have as common ground where we can plant the gospel truth into some existing experience or belief system. So faith and logic are no enemies. That would be the first thing that drove the apologist. The second is what I already mentioned earlier, is that the gospel is rooted in history. I'll just write that. Rooted in history. And I find that very important also nowadays, because at least in my country, very often you will hear people say, well, it is not so important to believe the miracles of the New Testament. Like, it does not matter whether Jesus actually stilled the storm, but the story wants to tell us that He can still the storm in our lives. Now, this is, who has heard this kind of explanation or strand of preaching before? Anyone here? Okay. Quite a number of people. Okay. So, on the surface, it sounds good. Yeah. You know, we don't really know whether He rose from the dead or whether He stilled the storm. But the meaning is so important. But when you go deeper, it doesn't even make sense. Because how can Christ, who at the time that He was on earth did not or could not still the storm, how can He still any storm in our lives that He now that He's not here? It doesn't really make sense, you see? But it's a kind of a Gnostic kind of re-symbolization. It is taking away the history and stressing a symbolic or mystical sense or an allegorical sense, but it does not actually value history. So that's what the early Christians did. And I will just read from my manuscript. The Gnostic assault against the Christian church consisted of a dehistorization, I call it, and a syncretistic re-symbolization. So they took away the history and they gave it new symbolic value. So basically, the Gnostics treated the Bible like a quarry. I don't know whether you know that English word. Quarry is where you get the stones out of the mountain, from which you could take names and concepts and thoughts, and then they would be reinterpreted and transformed into something totally different, into a totally alien set of beliefs, which was often a mix of mythologies, Neoplatonic thoughts. So the Christians stressed the rootedness in history, and this is the fight also that was in the church again and again over the centuries, is how important is the Old Testament. So, for example, in my country during Nazi times and the decade that led up to the political takeover of the Nazi and then the Third Reich, they would say, okay, the Old Testament is a Jewish book and we have nothing to do with the Jews. You see, we're Aryans, we're Germans. So we have to get rid of the Old Testament. It should not be in our Bible. Also, the Jewishness of Jesus is not really something that we can believe in. So Jesus was re-symbolized as somebody with blonde hair and a strong Germanic warrior type, an athlete, you know, but not like a Near Eastern Oriental looking person. And but this fight against the Jewish or history or the Old Testament was already there in the second century of the Christian church. And there was a guy by the name of Marcion or Marcion. I like to call him by the Greek name, Marcion. Now, this Marcion was a guy who reinterpreted the Christian faith, and he basically said, okay, let's get rid of the whole Old Testament because it speaks about, he called this, now that word is not so important, a demiurge, meaning the God of the Old Testament is not the ultimate God. He's an inferior God who created matter, and he is bad, he's vindictive, he is wrathful, he is not a nice character. But the real God is above this Old Testament God and the Creator. So the real God beyond, he sent Jesus. And so Jesus was against anything that the other God did, the God of the Old Testament. So he cut out the Old Testament. He cut out, he just accepted the Gospel of Luke, which he truncated, which he cut apart. Anything that was reminding of the Jewish history, he cut out. And he also just accepted the letters of Paul, but he also cut some parts out. So basically, this Marcion was quite rich, and he moved from Minor Asia to Rome, and he gave a donation to the Church of Rome, which was 250,000 sesterces. I don't know how to say that in English. Sestertia. It is the coin that they had in Rome, 250,000. And I recently, when I was talking about this, somebody was sitting in the audience, and because I said, I don't know how much that is. So the person actually Where is it? The person actually gave me a little note. Somewhere it is. I have it here. Where's my... Okay, I'll find it in a moment. Anyway, this person found out... Oh, here it is. I still have this note for some reason in my case here. And said, okay, how much is this in money nowadays? So he came to the church in Rome. And they thought he was a normal Christian guy. Around the year 150 or something like. And he gave them... So basically it is... 200,000 million euros. So it would be, what is that in billion? 2 billion. No, it was even more. Anyway, it's like 20, whatever, 20, an immense sum. He gave a lot of money to the church. So finally, when they realized that this guy was a heretic, he was a false teacher. He tried to change the Christian faith. They kicked him out of the church in Rome. And what do they think they did with his money? Number one, they kept it. Number two, they gave it to the poor. Number three, they gave it back to him. Who is for one? Kept it. They kept? They gave it to the poor? They gave it back. They gave it all back. They didn't want any of this money, okay? That should be an example for our church policy. So this guy had tried to buy this church and tried to get the Church of Rome to change to his system, and when they kicked him out, they gave him all the money back. I don't know whether with or without interest, but at least they gave it back. It's very interesting. Now this Marcion is also, if you want to look at early church history, look this guy up. Because he is like one of the... He's like a second stream. He's similar to the Gnostics, but not exactly. He's a character of his own, okay? Then the third thing, so over against this attempt by the Gnostics or by Marcion to kidnap the Bible and also to write new gospels, apocryphical gospels, the Christian apologists stressed the rootedness of the faith in actual and factual history. So the factuality of creation, the world is really created. It is not an emanation of some sort of an eternal spirit. It is created. It had a beginning. The reality of God's workings in the Old Testament, the reality of the incarnation, he really became flesh. He was really crucified on the cross. He really died. He was really bodily resurrected. And in contrast to this, pagan mythologies and Gnostic systems were shown by the Christian apologists to be products of the fanciful imaginations of their authors and were rejected as full of absurdities. And I will just take a little moment here to speak about the apocryphal gospels. I'm sure you have heard of the apocryphal gospels, the apocrypha. Now, what are these apocrypha? The word apocrypha means hidden. That's what it means. So apocrypha means hidden, hidden gospels. So there's the gospel of Mary Magdalene, there's the gospel of Philip, the gospel of Peter, the gospel of Thomas, which is a little bit of a, on its own, there's the gospel of the Acts of Pilate, and. And sometimes you read books, or you read, books like by Dan Brown or others, who say basically the church rejected these gospels because they were trying to hide the truth. Have you heard this argument before? You have, Andrew. Now, the reality is quite the other way around. These apocryphal gospels, I cannot say it, apocryphal gospels, these fake gospels, they started coming out around 150 after Christ. They never existed before that. So, say you were a Christian in Rome or in Lyon or in Alexandria in Egypt or in wherever in Oradea in Romania or wherever you may have been, and somebody suddenly comes up and says, I found a new gospel, but it's the real gospel. It's the gospel of Mary Magdalene and has been hidden for like 150 years. What would you say? The church, they didn't accept it because they knew that they were new forgeries. So they did not reject these gospels because they were mean or they're trying to keep the truth down. But they just said, no, no, this is nonsense. We've never heard of this before. We've never seen this before. And also, what they wrote in these gospels was totally contrary to the spirit of the historic gospels. So when you read the historic gospels, like John, Luke, Mark, Matthew, in reverse order, they're written in a very simple style. He got up and he went to Capernaum. Okay. And then he came to the house of Simon Peter, and there was Simon Peter's mother-in-law, and she was sick, and they asked Jesus, and he came in, and he touched her hand, and the fever went, and she stood up, and she cooked some food for them. So it's like even like a newspaper article, or like minutes. It's in a very simple style. Gospel of John is a little bit more fanciful, but it's still very simple. Now, these gospels, these apocryphal gospels, they would say something like, for example, then Jesus, who had risen from the tomb, gathered his 12 disciples on the Mount of Olives, and they sang a song, they held hands, and they went and they danced in a circle, and they sang the praise of the glorious cross. The cross is the victory over death. The cross is the help for the helpless. So the cross is, so you say, okay, this is a nice poem, but I cannot imagine Jesus dancing with his disciples in a circle and singing. You know, it's about a cross or something. It doesn't make sense. Or one of the gospels says, okay, when these apocryphal gospels says, women will become men so that they are worthy to enter the kingdom, which basically means that the women are inferior, and they cannot go to heaven unless they first become men by some transformational process. I don't know which way, but they will become men, and then they will. So anyway, the whole spirit of these apocryphal gospels is Gnostic in style. It's symbolic. And the church was right to reject them. In Germany, you probably have not heard this, but it was a big thing a few years ago, 20 years ago. Somebody claimed to have found the diaries of Adolf Hitler. Did you ever hear about this? Yeah, you heard about this. So it was a big story in one of our main newspapers. You know, the diaries of Adolf Hitler have been found. Of course, everyone was going, wow, you know. And it took some time for people to understand and to find out that these were forgeries. And this was nonsense. It was just somebody's trying to make a lot of money out of that. He had just written them. And that's how these apocryphal gospels were. And that's why also the apologists spoke against those apocryphal gospels. I will never get this word right today. But anyway, but it's amazing that even until this day, some people dig them up as if they were the actual truth. Or they will say that the writings from Qumran, they say something about Jesus Christ and the, where in reality they were all written before Jesus Christ even was born. It doesn't make sense, but there's a lot of stuff like this. So they were stressing the fact that it's rooted in history and the historic gospels are the true gospels and none of the other later gospels. And many of those gospels were lost and they were just refound. We only knew about them through the works of the Christian apologists, but then in the middle of the 20th century, some of them were found in Egypt, in Nag Hammadi, and now. And that shows how true and how faithful the Christian apologists wrote about these Gospels, because they reported exactly that which was now confirmed by those findings.